Welcome to the Proud to be Profane podcast, your initiation into the ways of the square, to resurrect the wretch and pee on the all-seeing pyramid of Illuminati enlightenment. And now, here's your host, Mr. Michael Joseph. Welcome to the Proud to be Profane podcast.
Welcome to episode number 29. Where we have a return guest in Mr. Tim Kelly, the host of Our Interesting Times. And so his return appearance now evens it out, as I've been on his show a couple times, he's been on mine a few times. So we've achieved an equilibrium of sorts. And that is a key theme in esoteric Freemasonry, the idea of equality, equilibrium, balancing out opposites. But how do you define that process? What are the distinctions and the details and the elements which you are balancing? And we will discuss this in relationship to the Masonic Wasp powers, balancing itself to be equal with the Catholic Church's universal mission, with their own universal mission of democracy, and trying to utilize the church to push this agenda. So this focus will be on the 20th century machinations that were engaging in this plan, and of which the Cold War was one of the main campaigns to try to unify or equilibrate the church with American democracy. And I am woefully inadequate to understand all of the things going on within this program or agenda. But that's why we have Mr. Tim Kelly on, because he has absorbed way more information on this than I have, and so we will discuss things like John Paul II, the Cold War, Henry Luce, his wife Claire Booth Luce, the Dulles brothers, and all of their relationships to the WASP establishment, and even perhaps secret societies like Skull and Bones, and the numerous fraternities associated with these elite WASP universities. We'll also talk about things like Operation Gladio, the P2 Lodge, and other odd connections that seem to balance out this opposition of left and right, liberal and conservative, or old and new. And they all seem to unify in their subversion, infiltration, and taming of this alleged beast of the Roman Catholic Church by the Liberty Goddess of Masonic Democracy. All right, welcome back to another P2BP episode, and we have a returning guest, Mr. Tim Kelly. And Tim, thank you for being back on the show. How are you?
Very well. Thank you for having me on.
So how are things going with your podcast? I'm sure most of our audience is familiar that you're the host of Our Interesting Times. Do you have any updates or news regarding the show? I know you had some censorship problems a little while back. Wonder what happened there and how have you adapted to that?
Well, I no longer post entire shows on YouTube. I promote it on YouTube. So there's no content on YouTube anymore. But I use that to provide links to where my show is posted. Well, I don't have to worry about censorship yet.
Yeah, I resorted to that just for a little while, a couple years ago. But luckily, I've been okay for the most part. So knock on wood here.
So there's certain things you can't talk about, and certain groups you can talk about, and certain groups you can't talk about, at least for any extended period of time. It's sporadic on YouTube because it appears arbitrary. In my case, it's probably an algorithm that catches it. I don't think they have a person following me. I don't think I have a case, officer assigned to me. I think it's all it's automated, artificial intelligence. Recently, of course, the past 6-7 weeks, I've been talking about the coronavirus, a so-called pandemic, scandemic, plandemic, the operation that it clearly is at this point. And so most of my material has been spent covering that. trying to expose and get as much information out as possible to hopefully if there's a wider awareness or consciousness about what's going on, this thing can be curbed or stopped before they impose a Bill Gates gets to impose this technocratic slave state on us all and his mandatory vaccines and his digital tattoos. And you know, are the immunity passports and the mandatory testing and the 24/7 surveillance that we're told that's being imposed to keep us safe from a virus that has now shows to have a mortality rate of that of the average flu season, if that.
Yeah, and I think that anytime I watch one of your shows or I go to your episode on YouTube, whether it's a link to something else, you always get the Wikipedia entry for whatever is below, you know, the coronavirus or Freemasonry or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
They always seem to be attached to your videos.
Yeah, they like to give us the official narrative of these things. Like if you talk about JFK or talk about 9/11, they're there to provide us the official narrative of these things, which, you know, something like JFK, I think as many as 70% don't buy the official narrative, yet it's promoted. In 9/11, you're probably dealing with maybe a third of the public is skeptical at this point. But yeah, they're kind enough to provide the official narrative.
Well, you can use it as a badge of honor, I suppose. So I guess today we're going to talk a bit about the 20th century in particular and relationship of the American Empire to the Catholic Church. And I guess before we begin, I'll just ask you, being a Catholic, what are your current views on Catholicism? Is the Novus Ordo valid? Is Francis really the Pope? For the record, I say yes to both of these, despite the horrible mess that's attached to each of them. But I certainly sympathize with all the other groups and everybody who takes issue with the Catholic Church in these days with all these difficult situations. But where do you stand on all these things, just so everybody can kind of know where you're at and you can give any disclaimers you'd like before people make assumptions?
Well, you know, Pope Francis has certainly made things interesting for Catholics, particularly those Catholics who see themselves as being more traditional or more orthodox or conservative. It's a I think he's Pope, just a not a very good Pope. In fact, perhaps a bad Pope. As you know, we know in history, there's been more than a few. His papacy, I think, who knows what God's intention is for this, but maybe it's in the end, it will precipitate a crisis, which will, you know, bring about good, which is what God does with things, I suppose. He is a Jesuit, and right now the Jesuit order is problematic, I think, how it's currently, you know, basically how it exists today. I think it's definitely a fifth column within the church now, a sort of a globalist modernist fifth column. That's promoting heresy and hurting the church. And now is the time it really should be dispersed, as you know. Whereas back in the 18th century, it shouldn't have been. But we, you know, obviously, what we've seen lately, the Catholic Church, not only in America but also in Europe, their response to the so-called pandemic has been nothing short of scandalous. I think it verges on apostasy when they've closed down all the churches, particularly just during Holy Week of all times. And that timing, I don't think, is coincidental. Right now, we have a clergy which doesn't see itself as being outside or opposed to the state. Perhaps this is the rotten fruit of Americanism and idea that the church and the state, not only are they separated, but the church forms a completely subordinate role to the state and actually becomes subsumed by it. I think that's what we're seeing with the Catholic Church today. It's becoming a through the papacy of Pope Francis, it's been further infiltrated and become a tool of globalism. And that's something that's very disturbing. Now, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't go to church. Of course, they've denied us that, haven't they? And so this willful denial of the sacraments to the flock, I think, is an act of apostasy and betrayal. We have a priest and bishops that don't think they have to question or challenge the state. And they're very naive or they're very corrupt. Either way, the Catholics are being denied the sacraments. And the spiritual results of that, I think, are awful.
There's been some more stronger voices in opposition to all that within the church, but there's very few of them. And there's not that many in America, I've noticed. And that's kind of the point of our topic today. dealing with the American Empire and its strange relationship to the Catholic Church or people being Catholics in America. Once I started looking more into the history, it made a lot of things make sense in terms of my own life and my own upbringing, things that have been kind of hidden from me.
Well, I mean, yes. So yes, my set of vacantism. And of course, it's a problem of that is it says that the chair of St. Peter is empty since the death of Pius XII, I believe. There hasn't been a legitimate pope since then. And to that position, what it says is that Jesus' commission to the church and his promise that the gates of hell should not prevail against it wasn't true. And so that undermines the entirety of Catholicism. So there's something wrong with that. Now, that said, I wish the chair, looking at Francis, I wish the chair of St. Peter was empty right now. And then we have the strange position of the, Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, and so the church created this ambiguity now, when Benedict resigned in February 2013. It's a tough time. There have been tough times in the past, and so this isn't anything really unique in history, in the sense that there have always been troubled times in the church. This recent crisis. The coronavirus, which I think is largely a contrived crisis, the church has not, come out looking very good in this, because they immediately closed all the church without any questioning. It's been voluntary, and the part of the Catholic Church has been technically voluntary. And to this day, I think the bishops are still hiding under their beds right now. I'm not saying anything.
Yeah, and while the liquor stores are open, and I think the Planned Parenthood's still open, things like that.
Yeah, basically, going to the church has been relegated the equivalent of going to a baseball game or something. It just simply isn't necessary, And we have a situation like in Illinois where you have a Jewish governor keeping the churches closed, so, giving him the pretext of science to do it. We have scientists now telling us when we should go to church, because they're scientists.
Yeah, and they always get their numbers right.
Yes, the scientists. Well, like I said, science isn't an exact science; it's an art, and so we're off by a factor of 1,000 or 2,000 or 10,000. It's modeling, right? It's modeling. You can wear a mask. You shouldn't wear a mask. if it looks good on camera, you wear a mask. So all of a sudden, now everyone in Congress is wearing a mask. The White House, they're wearing masks. Even though Anthony Fauci completely contradicted him, saying you shouldn't wear masks. They don't work. They actually spread disease. They creates a septic environment for disease. The pores in the mask are larger than the droplets of the virus, if it exists at all. And so, but it's an important act of public humiliation and subservience to the PSYOP, because people wear masks, they're literally muzzled from speaking to each other.
Yeah, it's everyone looks
yes.
like an animal or a dog with a muzzle. And I think that's, in my opinion, a result of a lot of these Enlightenment principles, which basically in its philosophy reduces man to an animal. And then if everything becomes very pragmatic to achieve whatever those goals might be, you can see how that is built in opposition, not only the church, but also has this contradiction that's kind of built into America, and perhaps we just see it manifesting over and over and over again, where we all live our lives in a contradiction in many ways. And I'm very guilty of this myself and trying to pull myself out of it a bit. But I think that our conversation today can kind of flesh out where a lot of this really took over the church in a very heavy way in the mid 20th century.
And back, I'm sorry, harping on this, because that's on everyone's mind now, because I think it's a continuing crisis. They can go many different directions at this point. This could be the apocalypse, if you will, the final battle. Is if you give into wearing masks, you're giving into the idea that there's a unique virus out there, that we can no longer have gatherings. We can no longer go to church. We can no longer have political rallies or protests. And this, what that does is it destroys the right to free assembly, peaceful assembly, and destroys the right to free exercise of religion, all under the guise of a public health crisis, which, again, at this point, isn't unique. There's no really unique crisis out there. It's just something that they've hyped. If they hadn't hyped it, people wouldn't be aware there was even a problem out there. But the church authorities, the other hierarchy, have given a free pass for the political authorities to shut everything down. And to me, that's almost like the reductio ad absurdum of Americanism of itself.
Like the culmination of it.
Yes.
Well, I think I'm not really super well versed in this area, and that's why I had you on. But I do know that one of the common criticisms or the accusations of sort of luring the church into Americanism is the Cold War and the fight against communism, and then Pope John Paul II being kind of one of the people spearheading this alliance. So for you, I would ask, is this idea of the church aligned against communism with America, is this something that you were brought up to believe or believed in yourself? And how has that perspective shifted over time? And do you still think there's some general truth to that narrative, even if it's mixed in with some darker components or compromises that have been ill-fated for the church in general?
Well, the Cold War. We have to go a little further back in the history, and that's the 20th century and the Catholic Church in the United States, where Catholics did very well materially in the United States, particularly the Irish coming relative to their experience in Ireland. And what happened was, and this is something that the church was aware of at the turn of the century, Leo XIII wrote about this, and is actually first, I think, addressed in Syllabus of Errors by Pius IX. And they were dealing with the general issues of materialism. This is the era of Darwinism, and so the church is trying to address these things. But the notion that the American system was the ideal system of separation of church and state. And so how does the church relate to that? And this was something that was developed before the Cold War. Actually, it was just before America's entry into the Second World War in 1941, the American Century, and I think it was an article written by Henry Luce, because he was the editor the head of Time Life Media Empire. There was Time Magazine, Life Magazine, later on Fortune, Sports Illustrated, but this publishing empire. And at the time, that was the primary vector for, basically for propaganda for the American state. But, radio was well established. It was growing. But this, of course, this was a decade before television. He came up with the idea that, I guess it was his, just coincided with Franklin Delano Roosevelt's The Four Freedoms. It was America's job as basically become the arsenal of democracy and spread American ideas of freedom around the world. And this time it was fighting fascism in Europe, Nazi Germany, Italy, fascist Italy, and also Japan in the Pacific, the Axis powers. Of course, they were defeated in 1945, and all of a sudden the new threat was our erstwhile allies, the Soviet Union. And now communism became the international threat to freedom. And so, but if you look what happened with, the Catholic Church, particularly, in Rome, was caught between, this pincer between the communists and the fascists. Of course, the Americans were allied with the communists during the war. In fact, that alliance was further back because, although it wasn't official, the creation of the Bolshevik state was largely financed by the Western powers, Anglo-American banking interests, particularly Jewish interests. And you can go why that was the case as part of the sort of ethnic animosity, antipathy towards Russia by many powerful Jews, people like Jacob Schiff. But also the Rothschilds' long-term geopolitical interest, which really, by that time, they had taken over the British Empire. And this goes into the Mackinder Doctrine and the strategies of Great Britain and its idea of how do you control the world? You have to control the continental powers if you're the sea power. But that's a digression. But anyways, the Anglo-American powers, and those Anglo-American powers after the war became the Anglo-American Zio powers. At this point, the Zionist powers might have been the junior partner, but they're gradually increasing their power, sort of inveigling themselves. And this would come by the late 70s, I think the WASP elite leadership was on the WASP power elite was on the wane, and you had the rise of Jewish power in the late 70s in the United States. And then we're seeing that today. But anyway, back to the Cold War is, if you're familiar with the broad history of the Second World War, is it created the conditions for the Cold War because it brought the Red Army into the heart of Europe. This was a direct consequence of the unconditional surrender policies that were established Tehran Conference in 1943. So if you destroy German power, you're going to create a vacuum that's going to be filled by Soviet power. And this was would create the Cold War, the Iron Curtain, and these things. Now, we're told through history this was just something unforeseen, that Stalin became, you know, no longer was cooperative, and he wanted to conquer Europe. So then the necessity for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the constant presence of American forces to hold back the Red Army. So we had our Cold War. And so the, you know, what happened was in Italy, I think it was in the 40s, they were holding the first free elections, the post-war era, and the CIA, which at the time sort of stretching its legs or was just a fledgling organization at that point, which had grown out of the OSS, but they had made sure that the Christian Democrats would win the elections over the leftist coalition government, which included communists. And so the CIA was brought in to sort of rig that election. And the Catholic Church was told either, if you don't help us out, the communists are going to win. Look what the communists are doing. And you can understand the fear, because what the communists had done in Eastern Europe, so in Poland, you had the cardinal that was mentally tortured and put in prison. And of course, this would also inform the papacy of John Paul II in the 1970s. And this alliance he had with Reagan and Thatcher to win the Cold War, as we're told. So the Catholic Church itself was given a choice, either support the West and freedom or communism and slavery. And they sort of begrudgingly chose the West as the lesser of two evils. But instead of sort of seeing this as a sort of a practical compromise, given a perilous situation, the Catholic Church was also targeted by the CIA. And this is what David Wemhoff writes about in his book, John Courtney Murray, Time, Life, and the American Proposition, How the CIA's Doctrinal Warfare Program Changed the Catholic Church. I've interviewed Mr. Wemhoff a couple of times, and that book is probably one of the most important books of the last 50 years. It tells, you know, what happened to the Catholic Church and what's happened to the world, because the CIA directly targeted the Catholic Church for infiltration. And how they did that was through agents like John Courtney Murray, who came to prominence in the 50s, in the late 40s, 50s, and early 60s, largely because of the patronage of Henry Luce, who was, again, the lead of Skull and Bones, head of Time Life. And if you know anything about the CIA and OSS, that ties back to Skull and Bones. So getting back to this rather elite group of WASPs at the time, which controlled the American, you know, the American elite at the time, Yale and Harvard and these things. And they were dedicated to the Cold War, and they saw the Catholic Church, all churches rather, as needing to be infiltrated and sort of brought on board the Cold War agenda. And the church being the largest religious institution with the most international reach, you know, having parishes throughout the world, it was particularly important to bring the Catholic Church on board. And they did that through funding, like I said, promoting John Courtney Murray's liberal ideas, and also even universities like Prodeo University in Italy, promoting American ideas of free enterprise and capitalism. And also the idea that the American state, the system of separation church state, was ideal. And the confessional state was now passé, was no longer valid in the modern era. And the church endorsed, you know, basically the Freemasonic Republic of the United States. And there was a huge, I think, intellectual infiltration of the Catholic Church. And there's some other darker examples of infiltration too. One would be the sexual corruption of the clergy, and largely done at the behest of Jewish and also CIA assets in the 50s and 60s. And of course, we saw that in the 1970s, and we're seeing how that culminated in the scandals of the early aughts, 2000, right after the year 2000, where all these scandals broke, like in Boston. And it wasn't just something that just happened. It was a product of decades and decades of not only infiltration of the Catholic Church, but a broad psychological warfare that was waged on the entire West that we call the sexual revolution.
So what do you think about Pope John Paul II? Because you mentioned that obviously there's a real tragedy and threat with, you know, everything happening from the Bolsheviks and everything that stemmed into. Where do you stand with all that? Because some people are very upset at his ecumenism and things like that. And then some people are more sympathetic because he came out of that area where a lot of that was going on, or that threat was legitimate and real. So what do you think about him? Is he somebody that was manipulated, or because of everything he went through, kind of went down that ecumenist path because of an idealism to prevent what he had already seen. And it was a traumatic thing, a reaction to the trauma that perhaps was a little bit more short-sighted or ill-fated, and there was a compromise there, but the intention is understandable. Or do you think perhaps there's more of a dark compromise attached to him and a bit more of a knowledgeable participation in New World Order agendas and Quran kissing? And I'm wondering, because I don't really know a lot about him other than the buzz or debate around these topics, and I'm not sure what I really even think about it. I'm probably more in the middle with it, I suppose, but what are your thoughts?
I have no particular insight whether it was something that was malicious on his part. I think it was sort of a intellectual and then therefore ultimately theological corruption. I mean, that grew out of, his ecumenical reaches, whereas an attempt to sort of create a broad coalition or understanding, but that can easily be corrupted. And he did, I think, didn't he go into a mosque, which popes are not supposed to do?
Yeah, that's usually the big issue that most people have.
And of course, we see it today with the Pope with that, was that South American idol?
Hoochie Mama?
You know, yeah, Hoochie Mama.
Pachi Mama.
But I thought it was like Pokemon or something when I first heard it.
Well, there'll be a Pikachu in the Vatican very soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, they have clown masks, so why not?
Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
And what's her name? What was that pop singer that went there? Katy Perry?
Probably. I'm not sure.
Was talking about like transcendental meditation. Now, Katy Perry and transcendental meditation or something. I don't know. So you have that. And this is sort of an ugly outgrowth, I think, of dignitatis humanae, I guess, would be this sort of this idea and also of nostra aetate, of religious freedom. The traditional teaching of the Catholic Church was error has no right. And what that meant was, that basically you have no right to proselytize. And of course, if you have a Catholic country, that country that is a Catholic state, you can, but the church condemned those things like Franco's Spain or something, where they sort of, the church sort of abandoned Franco. And then when Franco died, they instituted a liberal constitution, religious freedom. And now you see what's happening in Spain. They have gay pride rallies during Holy Week. And same thing in Portugal. But this is our idea, just because you can respect people's right to practice their own religion doesn't mean you have to celebrate it, or doesn't mean that you have to legitimize it the way, John Paul II did. And it is an interesting thing, because basically what he did was a violation or considered a heretical act by previous popes. So so you have an example of the sainted John Paul II doing that. And you can say, what was his intent? You can interpret that. But it's a product of this sort of the Vatican II, post-Vatican II Novus Ordo Church, where you water everything down, Church of Nice. The church now announces that it no longer needs to proselytize Jews, which means that, the church's official teachings is the only way through Christ is salvation is through the church. Now, if you tell people that they can attain salvation without being Catholic, why bother to proselytize? Why convert? And so you have this weakening of the church and sort of this in the post-Vatican II era, which sort of left the field open, for the cultural warfare that was waged by other parties or interests, you have the psychology of John Paul II, who, as Karol Wojtyła, he was in Poland and he experienced both the German and Russian occupations. So he was very easily moved to help, things like groups like Solidarity in Poland, which was financed by, say money going through the Vatican Bank, being funded with the source of these funds can be traced back to gun running and the international narcotics trafficking. And so you can see how these intelligence operations, the church can be brought along. You saw this with the Vatican Bank scandal and Bishop Marcinkus. And the this gets into sort of propagate the P2 Lodge and also the who's that guy who was hung out at Friars Bridge? The guy who ran the Banco Ambrosia. Roberto Calvi, the 1982. And this gets into some of the question regarding the death of John Paul I, of course, which His short, his papacy was a mere 33 days, interesting enough. And some people think he was poisoned, given, you know, a drug to give him a heart attack. And that's, of course, that cleared the path for John Paul II, who was less reform-minded.
So what do you think? I know you mentioned some of the WASP figures, Henry Luce. Maybe we could just focus on that little clique for a bit. There's the Dulles brothers involved, and Henry Luce, you said, was a bonesman?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I didn't know. I didn't realize that. That's interesting. And the other thing I was going to mention, just real quick, I don't know if I ever talked about this when I was on your show, but I found out that Carl Jung was a member of the OSS under Dulles. And we talked about all the weird Carl Jung symbolism in the JFK assassination. So I don't know what to think about that, but I just found that very interesting that he was agent number 488 under one of these Dulles brothers. So what is, can you elaborate on their role in all of this?
The Dulles brothers?
Dulles brothers and Luce, maybe just to give a little bit more background on that.
Right. Well, they weren't Skull and Bones. I think Dulles himself went to that New Jersey university. What's it? Princeton. And he was a member of some, I think it was a Scroll and Key or something over there. But he was, I think, the nephew of Robert Lansing, who's the Secretary of State for Woodrow Wilson. And so as a very young man, he grew up around these things. But he, you know, of course, he was there at Versailles in 1919 in Paris. And he was actually, he's credited with debunking the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is interesting, which then again, how valid is the debunking if it's Alan Dulles doing it? So, but he and his brother, you know, grew up adjacent to power, and so they were, you know, became very important Wall Street lawyers. Their law firm was elite connected, it was Dulles who was, of course, a member of the OSS in Switzerland during war. He did negotiations with SS General Karl Wolf, and he was behind Operation Paperclip, the sort of the transporting of Nazis west, the sort of this pipeline of Nazis to escape west, who would then come in and, sort of populate our post-war intelligence agencies, General Reinhard Gehlen, who was head of the German intelligence in the East, would form the Soviet desk, you know, within the OSS and CIA. And so you wonder why we had a Cold War. it was they also utilized the Vatican for this as well, allegedly for this pipeline. A lot of bribery and money changed hands. Of course, Dulles would also make off or at least broker, handle a lot of the plunder from World War II with the Swiss bank accounts. That's very murky now. But that was his background. What was that law firm again? The Dulles Law Firm?
I am not sure. Dulles Law Firm?
Yeah, you know, I know the name. He's the tip on my tongue.
Look it up real quick. Sullivan and Cromwell?
There we go. Yeah, Sullivan and Cromwell. That's very important. Thanks. Sullivan and Cromwell. I knew it. The point of that is Sullivan and Cromwell was a well-connected Wall Street law firm, which represented corporations. And it was these corporations, people like Dulles, Robert Lovett, and these, they would form the nucleus of not only the OSS, but the CIA. And so this relationship between corporate America, high finance, and intelligence agencies was there at the beginning. And so the sort of incestuous, untoward relationship between big business and government, which you could see in the Spanish-American War, even as far back as the American Civil War, was sort of consummated in 1947 with the National Security Act. And it was the Cold War which created the pretext for this reorganization of America's intelligence and defense establishment. And so this reorganized and created a permanent national security state, what we have today, these alphabet soup agencies. It was the Cold War that created the immediate crisis for this. And Dulles was there to set this up, and I believe he wrote the report. Was important in organizing this. In fact, I think he was expected. He was the speechwriter for Thomas Dewey in the 1940 election against Harry S. Truman, and Truman's victory. Dulles expected to be the first director of the CIA, but it was Truman's surprise victory in 48 over Thomas Dewey, which means he had to put off his put that off until Eisenhower became president in 1953. And that's when he assumed the directorship of the CIA in 1953 until he served until the spring of 1961, or I think maybe it was the summer of 61, when Kennedy eventually sacked him over the Bay of Pigs fiasco. But it was those formative years that Dulles really oversaw the expansion of the CIA, not only in its budget, but also its capabilities, using sort of bureaucratic ingenuity to expand it, because technically speaking, the CIA wasn't really supposed to be engaged in these things. But he used broad language in the National Security Act to justify active, the fun and games branch intelligence. Instead of just gathering, collating and gathering intelligence from various agencies, CIA became an active agency. And of course, we can see that in on behalf of under the cover of national security in fighting communism, but really it's always on the behalf of companies like United Fruit Company in Guatemala in 1954, or for the Seven Sisters Oil Companies in Iran in 1953, when they staged a coup that threw out Mossadegh and installed the Shah, who reigned for another 26 years until the 79 Iranian Revolution.
Yeah, it's funny. You said the ambiguity, that's one of those weaponized things that was utilized with Vatican II as well. So it's kind of the temporal version and the spiritual version.
Yeah. And if you want to know how these formative years, I think Fletcher Prouty's book is very good on that. The Secret Team, about the early days of the CIA and how it really grew in, came to its own in the 50s and 60s, and why perhaps they were so shocked in 1962 or 63 when Kennedy actually challenged them and started acting like a president. And this would perhaps contribute to his murder in November 1963, because CIA, as well as other parties, all have their hands all over that.
Do you know much about the role of Avery Dulles in this? Because he was a Jesuit who became, involved in high up in the Catholic Church, was a cardinal, I think. So what do you know about him?
Mm-hmm. He converted, apparently. He said he converted looking at a tree one day. I think walking, was it in Boston? I forget where he was, but he said by just admiring a tree, he decided to convert to. He was sort of a agnostic, and that's when he decided to become a Christian, particularly a Catholic. But his rise to the Catholic Church is interesting, because given Brother John Foster Dulles was the Secretary of State and Allen Dulles, head of the CIA, pretty much controlling America's foreign policy, both covert and overt, for a better part of a decade, and then have him become a prince of the church eventually is somewhat suspect. He was doctrinally or rocks rather conservative, but if you look at the issue of Americanism itself, figures like Avery Dulles and other princes of the American Catholic Church, like Spellman, were unequivocal Americanists at a time, when the American empire was at its peak, is particularly, during the Cold War. And so I have no actually information on his actual involved in any intelligence operations, other than perhaps a sort of an intellectual corruption of the Catholic Church, which was important because they had to keep the church online at that point. And this is also the 50s and 60s with a broad psychological warfare waged against American Catholics, particularly ethnic Catholics, with not only the collapse of the production code and the corruption of American pop culture through suburbia. And also racial integration, supposed racial integration, where they brought in blacks from the South to bust up ethnic Catholic neighborhoods in the North to create suburbia. And therefore, you deracinate these Catholics, and they become sort of bland white Americans, which can easily be targeted and be called racist as they are today.
It's interesting you're saying about Avery Dulles that doesn't seem to be as many suspicious things tied to him. And that might relate to Henry Luce and his wife Claire Booth Luce, who was a famous Catholic conversion and tied to Fulton Sheen, helping to enable that. So what is your viewpoint on her in relationship to her husband, who's a guy who's tied to the WASP New World Order side of the coin? could this be more like a Wheat and the Tares thing? Is she just another agent of this or a dupe? What is your thought on her? Because she seems to be rather controversial, similar to what we talked about with John Paul II. Kind of hard to really understand what's going on there. What's your view on her role in all this, being married to this guy who's such a key figure in trying to subvert the Catholic Church?
Yeah, there are people who think Claire Ruth Luce was a devout Catholic. However, I read in a book called The Irregulars, where apparently she had an affair with Roald Dahl, the British agent. Now, that's what he claims. He was sent, Roald Dahl, he was the famous author, children's stories, these things. He was a RAF agent who had gotten injured, I think, during the Battle of Britain, and then was sent over to work in William Stevenson's operation to sort of get America into the war. And so he was this sort of this dashing RAF agent, RAF pilot who came wearing his uniform, and he was there to sort of promote the British interests and promote America's support for their war effort against Nazi Germany, and of course ultimately get America into the war. And there's a broad, you know, during that time, during those desperate hours, 40, 41 with Britain, there was a broad cultural, propaganda attempt at Hollywood. And of course, all the major news outlets were on board with this. You had Franklin Delano Roosevelt, this was sort of the sine qua non of his administration in 1940, 41, was to get America into the war by hook or by crook. And eventually he did do that. In that book, The Irregulars, it says that he was women were used to, attractive women were used to seduce American senators. I think Senator Arthur Vandenberg was caught up in one of these things. But Claire Ruth Luce apparently had an affair with Roald Dahl, which he claims. And of course, she was about 15 years older than he was. And someone asked him about that. He said, when doing this, he just thought of England.
James Bond stuff, right?
James Bond stuff. But she eventually became what the American ambassador to Italy in the 1950s, I think under the Eisenhower administration. Of course, that's when Henry Luce goes there, I think gives his speech about the American proposition. The American proposition is that the American ideals were the best. They were ideal for everybody, and they need to be expanded throughout the world. And this would expand markets and create sort of this homogenous free capitalist system throughout the world. And basically traditional societies would have to go away. And that's what had happened in Italy, but also we saw that happening throughout the world in the Cold War, Coca-Cola and the good life would be spread, where this was his speech. And of course he's there visiting his wife as the ambassador to Italy at the time. So I don't know. I mean, who knows to what extent she was a faithful Catholic or not? I mean, I can't plumb her mind or what her intent was. Like anything, it's probably ambiguous at the time because she probably thought she was doing good. I mean, it's very, you can see how someone would think that their country is the best, their system is the best. But there is an interesting quote in, here it is, chapter 4 in his book, Claire Ruth Luce, American Catholics Can Succeed. How she says that, American Catholics, particularly Irish Catholics, have an inferiority complex, and they want to be accepted. They work for the WASP elite, and they want to be sort of have their place at the table. And we see that with American Catholics today, particularly those in political power, how they just want to climb the pole of political power. And we see it with judges who are asked, can you put your dogma aside and become a judge? Whereas if you're a Jew and you're appointed to the court, no one asks about the Talmud. When you're being appointed to the court, can you put your beliefs aside. Here it is. In a letter to Bishop Fulton Sheen, the man she claimed was responsible for her conversion to Catholicism, Claire explained that the church was being harmed in America because it was implicated in the principles inimical to the faith, like religious liberty and disestablishment. Oh, I do not understand how it is with the church in America, how sweet it is to be long last at the right side of the tracks, and to be in the religious field, as one of my Catholic friends put it, and a real up and comer. Oh, could it be that the church itself is beginning to be just a little bit like the rich young man? Men, I say, should not spend all their novenas and so much of their life of prayer in inner contemplation, not in times like these that call for eagles and lions and tigers of the Lord, ravage the world with the truth of Christ crucified. This is a lush land of glittering corruption. No king but saints and martyrs can save us now. So basically, demo David Wilmhoff goes on to write, Clare was understood the nature of America as being inescapably pragmatic. American Catholics spend little time trying to convert their neighbors and are always being bawled out by their priest for this lassitude, but they make up for it by contributing to the missions. So basically, you know, you have the hierarchy, which are brick and mortar men. They have their churches and they do well. They grow very fat and soft in America. As you ever shake a hand of a priest, it's very soft. And this is the problem in the church in America today. That quote is great. How basically, you know, she was Catholic, but now she could be Catholic and have a seat at the table because of Americanism. Whereas the proper position or I think pose for a Catholic should be outside the system seeking to convert as opposed to getting inside. But it's very easy to rationalize it to be going inside, because not only can you tell yourself that you're having an influence, making a difference, but you're also getting rich in the process.
Yeah. And I think I've read some quotes. I can't remember who, but you were mentioning some more current Catholic politicians. There was somebody talking about the history of anti-Catholicism in America, and they kind of blame themselves for it, where they'll say, you know, like the church has been pretty intolerant and, you know, that's a mistake. And the fear of Catholic immigration is warranted or justified because of that. And mostly referring to the 19th century immigration. But even though they'll admit that there was some bad persecutions of Catholics and stuff like that, they kind of exonerate the WASP establishment from it. And this is coming from Catholics. I've heard that before. And then, of course, look at the results of what's happened with that mindset. Or on the flip side, to justify their rise in politics and to be pragmatic, like America inclines us all to do, they basically state, well, in order for us to get into politics to change this, we have to compromise with our beliefs. So it's kind of like a catch-22, but they're saying they don't really have much of a problem with that, and that this is justified because they don't have the equal rights, and the only way to get the rights is to compromise to get into power to change it. And so it's ironically kind of like the justification of Jewish rabbis giving to the conversos, saying, oh, if you convert, then you'll get into the establishment, even if you're not sincere, and then you can survive and get rights that way by changing things from within. So that's the irony here. It becomes very much like the plight of the Jews when they didn't have the equal rights, whereas when the Catholics have that problem, there is this Americanist proposition, as you were saying, to basically engage in that same type of mindset or thinking. And then again, on the flip side of that coin, the idea of the Jews infiltrating or subverting mimics this in what the concerns are about the Catholics, where they're going to basically get into politics and make everyone, you know, a slave to a popish plot or a Catholic universal conspiracy or agenda or a Jesuit conspiracy, right? So it's kind of funny how there's a broad similarity for both the Catholics and Jews, except for the differences. There is a Jewish tradition with Christ and a Jewish tradition without him. So as I mentioned, there's those Catholics that sympathize with the WASPs and think that, you know, there's a reason to be suspicious of all these Catholics because they're going to try to subvert American democracy. And,
yeah,
you know, that's kind of like 19th century WASP propaganda. That's like a carryover. And, you know, it's just such a strange situation. And I was reading a book called Transatlantic Anti-Catholicism, and I was amazed that everything the WASP establishment projected onto the Catholic Church, the church has kind of actually become that today, even though back then it wasn't, and that was part of the propaganda. But the WASP establishment completely inverted its conservative values that it was boasting of at the time. And now it actually embraces the church version that it used to hate that it became. So there's this really grand irony. It actually has become through the Jesuits. So back then they were accusing the Jesuits and again, this is the 19th century Jesuits, very different, of being like these androgynous, effeminizing people who were, you know, living with the savages or like hanging out in the Amazon, right? And that the savages were bad back then. Now, obviously, we have a very different viewpoint of the Native American cultures. But it's like everything that the WASP establishment projected the Catholic Church to be, it wasn't at the time. And now this kind of Novus Ordo version or Americanized version has become what they accused it of being in the propaganda during the 19th century. And at the same time, what the WASP establishment in the 19th century boasted of being, which was a male hierarchy and the male's the head of the family and that's just the great Christian life, where that's been entirely reversed, where everything is all feminism and the man can't be the leader of anything, or it's just as equal as, you know, the woman's CEO or the modern family show and all that kind of stuff. And they haven't even measured up to their own criteria of what a progressive nation was back in the 19th century. So it's just so ironic how things had reversed to the complete opposite. And it's just all kind of a, you know, reflecting this 20th century and this transmutation of it all. And so like the Catholic politicians, quote unquote, it's interesting because they end up being the worst, you know, Podesta or Pelosi or Cuomo or all these figures that are such a huge problem in all of this. So is that a result of losing the faith? They actually become the biggest problem.
Andrew Cuomo, who says that despite being Catholic, he was raised in the Talmud.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
His father taught them these values. Tecumseh Ronnie, he taught them these values. Now, I don't know if that's just pandering on his part, but it's like E. Michael Jones says, they are Judaizers when they embrace sort of the Americanist system, the Americanism. And modernism is largely a Jewish outlook on life, which gets into sort of the puritanical thing, either, you know. But I think it was Mary Schleskine who says, you know, it was a book, 20th century is the Jewish century, and so it's what he means by that is not people haven't converted to Judaism, but they've internalized the values of Talmudic Judaism, post temple Judaism, and this was done largely through the, you know, sort of the take over the culture in the post-war era, you know, through cinema and music and these things, and also through usury. And this goes in the financial system. That's another thing where the Catholic Church is sort of has abandoned its condemnation of usury, which has set up sort of this economic system, this unsustainable system, which just accumulates increasing amount of wealth in a smaller number of hands, which we're seeing today. Now I think we're seeing fully weaponized in sort of this economic coup that we saw under the cover of the COVID-19 pandemic.
So kind of discuss the WASP side of the coin. I was wondering if maybe you wanted to get into some of the Catholic subverters or Judases, perhaps. People like you mentioned, John Courtney Murray. Also, there's other folks that are popular names that come up in terms of the Jesuits, like Teilhard de Chardin. I don't know if there's anybody you wanted to mention in particular to that or elaborate on those figures.
Well, I mean, I guess John Courtney Murray, who again was promoted by Henry Luce in the late 1940s and sort of became a Catholic celebrity in the 50s. I think he put him on the cover of Time Magazine, or, you know, get on the cover of Time Magazine, you're somebody back then. Up there with Marilyn Monroe and Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin. But this is his idea. I think he wrote a book called We Hold These Truths. And this was idea that America, if you hold to the constitutional principles and idea of free exercise of religion and tolerance, and as the American state, sort of remains good, then and it's a comfortable position for Catholics to be in. And his job at Vatican II, and this was with Dignitatis Humanae, was to get the Catholic Church to change its official position on these teachings of separation of church and state. Again, up until then, the Catholic position was just sort of a practical modus vivendi with such a system. It wasn't a promotion that it was ideal. And since then, we have popes, particularly Francis, saying, you know, that the confessional state is no longer valid. Separation of church and state is ideal. And again, that is a complete contradiction of church teachings. it goes against, you know, the confessional state, and sort of an integral society. And we're seeing today the weaknesses of such a system, that how what that really does is, when you create a situation of separation of church and state, a tolerance for our religions, what it really does, neuters religion, because it just makes it something you do on Sunday, and it frees up the field for the oligarchs, private interest, to control the system under the guise of freedom. And through psychological warfare and through NGOs and we're seeing a lot of talk about foundations now with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, how foundations and how their dominance of the media and education, how under the guise or the appearance of sort of heterodox freedom, they can control the agenda. And there's no institution that resists it, the corporate state, because the church has been effectively neutered, because the church holds no special power within society, because there is no integralism in society to fight it. Whereas in a Christian commonwealth or Catholic state, that wouldn't be the case. The church should be outside the state and equal to the state. It could wag its finger and control things. And we're seeing sort of the empty promises of a constitutional democracy or republic. We have all these parchment claims or promises of freedom, but we're as we're seeing today, those parchment promises are meaningless. And there's nothing to control the state when the church is relegated to a subordinate and even a propagandizing agent of the state, which we're seeing today with the Catholic Church, particularly the American Catholic Church, when it's actually there promoting something like this operation, the COVID-19 operation. It's out there actually. It's part of the PSYOP, and that's what's most very discouraging. But that go back to John Courtney Murray, was he was promoted for these ideas. He became a celebrity. People knew who he was because Henry Luce controlled the media empire, which made him a celebrity. So it's one of these sort of these prefab celebrities, sort of these court intellectuals. He's sort of a court priest who's there to sort of legitimize these ideas in the eyes of American Catholics who are already, you know, sort of bought into the American system because they're American Catholics, particularly Irish American Catholics. And this, so this is at that critical moment in Vatican II when he was trying to get this changed. And although technically he didn't get it changed, what it did was he was able to have his ideas promoted by the media empire. And most people, again, most Catholics wouldn't read the church documents, but they would read the media coverage of it. And that's the same thing with Vatican II, the ambiguity of Vatican II, where it doesn't really say specifically, in fact, technically the Vatican II actually says you have to protect traditionalism in terms of church and how churches are designed, but it wasn't really enforced, and then we saw modernism and architecture in the 1970s take over. Same thing with the liturgy, but you could the devil's in the details, and I would say you could say it was naivete, but the ambiguity creates the opportunity for the corruption, and the interpretation of documents like Dignitatis Humanae and Vatican II would be controlled by Masonic outfits like Henry Luce's media empire, Time Life, and they were going to control the agenda, in which they did. And that's something that the church, remember Vatican II, the church was trying to deal with the modern world and deal with things like modern communication and these things. But as we now know, that from the get-go, the council was infiltrated and manipulated. And what they didn't get technically on paper, they got after the fact with the spin or how it was interpreted in the media.
What do you think are some good books, along with this John Courtney Murray book by David Wenhoff, that would help illustrate this or this infiltration or steering the narrative? Is there any specific ones you'd recommend?
Well, from what I've read, a good broad history of sort of America and Catholicism is Charles Colomb's book, Puritan's Empire.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
And that's a good one. But also, Solange Hertz, I think, wrote a book called A Star Spangled Heresy, which writes about this. She writes about that, I think. So that's a good book on that particular subject. But I do think sort of the most detail and the most, I think, concise treatment of this in a way is David Wenhoff's book. Because I don't think without reading that, no Catholic has a full understanding of where he is or where they are right now without knowing that history. It explains so much. Another good book, I think, would be E. Michael Jones's book, The Slaughter of Cities, which is about urban how urban renewal, racial integration was used in the post-war era to bust up the ethnic neighborhoods. This was psychological warfare, social engineering in the middle of the 20th century. And also his book that predates it is on the, it deals with Philadelphia, but it's John Coldner Kroll and the Cultural Revolution. And he gets into what happened in Philadelphia in the 1960s to the 1980s and the destruction of the Catholic neighborhoods there and the weaponization of racial integration. And basically how the Catholic, and this is a good example because it shows how the Catholic hierarchy are completely unaware or at least unable to cope with or address the reality of covert psychological warfare, covert cultural warfare that the American state, primarily through the foundations, used to fundamentally change the operating system of the American empire. They were able to inject these viruses that changed the culture, that turned us into sort of this degenerate Masonic republic we are today, which is so ripe for manipulation and so atomized that most people simply don't have the agency or the community to fight back against, the state, the corporate state.
I hear you. And it's interesting because so much of what you're talking about is just a modern version of what I've been reading was happening in the French Revolution and Barrowell's Memoirs of Jacobinism. The difference is back then, the people who saw through this were the Jesuits. And during this time, they're starting to get all into the liberation theology, social justice stuff, it would seem, or at least there's a couple key figures here at Vatican II that are the Jesuits that are nothing like the Jesuits of old or people like Barrowell. And so it's very sad to see it all going down, especially when people, they really don't want to see that ugly subversion and the ill will of mankind, even though there's smiling faces. And I think that is really largely a Masonic thing anyways, you know, this sort of like esoteric, exoteric agenda. And that's kind of part of the American culture where everybody wants to believe that mankind is inherently good as long as he's given all the stuff to, you know, survive and there's no material lacking. And obviously in our current state, I would say that is absolutely being proven completely wrong. But that aside, before we wrap up the first hour here, I was wondering if maybe you want to go through some key figures in Catholicism who you think spoke out and warned against such things and were embodying the traditional spirit of the church in spite of all of this subversion or people just being duped.
Well, you have in the struggle between the Americanists and the traditional Catholics during Vatican II. And in the 20th century, the middle of the 20th century, you have, I think it was Monsignor Fenton and was one who warned against it. And you have figures like, what was his name? It was Father Carroll who warned against it. And it goes to the villains, you know, people like Malachi Martin, perhaps, and John Courtney Murray. There's some who are agents. Malachi Martin himself, I think some people suspect, was the agent of B'nai B'rith. He's the one that tried to get the church to change its teachings regarding the Jews and their responsibility for the crucifixion of Jesus Christ in Nostra Aetate. And he didn't get it, but he got sort of the church said that not all Jews are responsible for it, which is self-evident because, you know, not. It's the Sanhedrin and the followers of the Sanhedrin who crucified Jesus Christ. There were many Jews who didn't, and they eventually they would become Christians. But nevertheless, this set the pattern for the next few decades of the church reaching out, looking for dialogue, and the Jews using it as a weapon against the church in their cultural warfare against the West.
What about popes? Any particular popes warning of Americanism or modernism?
Oh. Not since Leo the 13th, I don't, at least not to my knowledge. I mean, Pius the 12th. I mean, it really didn't. I mean, I guess it didn't become an issue that maybe that was talked about a lot until after the Second World War. Although again, we do have Pope Leo the 13th in the 1890s writing about it. I think his papacy ended in 1902, writing about it. But then you have, you know, Benedict, I think that was it Benedict the 15th after that or 14th. But then you have the First World War. There were some priests who wrote about this. And of course you have, you know, oh, what was it, the Canadian priest? You know, the radio guy.
Oh, was it Coughlin?
Yeah, Father Coughlin. You know, who was actually the church shut him down. So this is an example. The American church shut him down. The Roosevelt administration made them do this. So much to free speech. So much, again, so much for this liberal Democratic promises of free speech, right? His radio show, you know, they made them, he put pressure. The Franklin Roosevelt administration made the Catholic Church, I think they shut his radio station down. Then they stopped delivering his, like, his newsletter in the mail. And Father Coughlin, being obedient, priest, stopped talking about these things. But you had priests like him, you know, who talked about, you know, public interest, this stuff. He was sort of like, you know, he talked about, of course, the Jewish influence in the Roosevelt administration and high finance, and also ultimately getting us into the war. But he was shut down. So you did have priests who were willing to take these things on, but they were eventually muzzled or marginalized.
Yeah, and then you consider that the popes, you know, leading up to World War II, they were dealing with a lot of crazy stuff going on in Europe, not to mention the wars themselves. And this is something I talked about a little bit with Dr. Robert Sengenis, and we're talking about geocentrism, where they kind of removed themselves from the cosmology argument during the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder if it has something to do with all the Masonic revolutions they were dealing with. So certain things are more preoccupying of your time than others, especially when you're, you know, fighting for your Catholic life in Austria and Italy during those times. So,
yes. I mean, at that time you had the papacy dealing with Mussolini and you had the Lateran Treaty. And then you have the Concordat with Hitler and the sort of this pragmatic, you know, agreement with these regimes, which were, you know, somewhat hostile. Although I think, although looking back at it, people criticize the Catholic Church's relationship with these things. But what were they to do at that point? And the broader understanding of these conflicts is that many fathers. And if you look at both the First World War and the Second World War, it wasn't just an example of, you know, Hitler and Mussolini wanting to take over the world. It was a conflict that was sort of stoked and created by the banking interests. And you really can't separate the Second World War from the First World War. Second World War, it wasn't just a culmination in chronological terms. It was sort of a culmination of a broad 30 years war waged against the continental powers by the Anglo-American Zio interests, which you know, which have been dominant since. And we see that struggle continuing today, you know, vis-a-vis Russia and perhaps even China. But it's very murky and convoluted, and there are no clear good guys or bad guys in these things. And what's really confusing is that the nation-state boundaries don't really mean much, you know, at this point. It's geographically, Russia may matter, but, you know, Russia is very infiltrated, and they have it's not like, you know, Russia good, West bad, or vice versa. It's the world isn't that simple or clear cut, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think what you were mentioning earlier about the church being in this predicament in those world wars, and then also at the same time this idea of constitutional rights, but they happen to magically get bypassed or overlooked often when it comes to Catholicism or people like Father Coughlin. And, you know, looking into the earlier stages of, you know, the United States, you know, before the Revolution, it was basically any religion but Catholicism. There was even, I forget the Mason's name. I think it's James Oglethorpe. He was involved in blaming the fires in 1741 on the Catholics. And then he was also involved in getting the first Masonic lodge in Georgia called Solomon's Lodge. And when they had Jews coming into that community, people were wondering, well, should we give them religious tolerance? And he basically organized, said, yes, we can give them religious tolerance, just not the Catholics. So here's a Mason doing that. But the funny thing is, too, there's another angle to this where there's this propaganda of the West to try to conflate the Catholic Church with the Nazis a lot of the times, which is absurd if you actually look into it. But at the same time, nobody has a problem, or nobody mentions, I should say, you know, the Zionist Jews working with the Nazis to try to get establishments in Palestine. everyone will say, well, you can't conflate those things. Those things have nothing to do with each other, which is, you know, fair enough. But why are you trying to conflate Catholicism and its quote unquote anti-Semitism under the religious or spiritual understanding with the Nazis' versions of that based upon, you know, the more pagan biological determinism? And so it seems that when it comes to the Catholic Church, they don't want to make the distinctions that would help exonerate it. And they don't have a problem, you know, throwing all kinds of things into that muck to try to slander it.
Well, part of that is sort of this, the course of the demonization of Germany that occurred in the 20th century, particularly in the Hitler period, which is sort of this cartoon, which I would suggest needs, you know, some serious revising or reconsideration or refining. It just simply isn't what it, we've taught it what it was. And you know, Germany had a huge Catholic population. They had a their culture, their culture war in the 19th century, Bismarck, and sort of a modus vivendi was struck, which solved Germany's problem. Then Germany became this industrial giant, which had to be knocked down a peg or two. Britain saw it couldn't compete with them economically. And then, you know, I think it was it Balfour who said, you know, was asked, how to compete, you know, how do we deal with Germany? Can't we just work harder and compete with them economically? And the, and he said, no, we just have to go to war with them. And this was in the early 20th century. I mean, that's broadly speaking what the second 30 years war was. You know, and so there's a dialectic within Germany that's manipulated. So you have the rise of Hitler. And of course, his rise is very curious, the funding he got. I'm not one of those people who think that Hitler was an explicit British agent, but he did set Germany up, you know, for the eventual fall. And he took the bait at the very least, and led to Germany's destruction as an independent power in Europe. But the that you know, again, the whole idea that the Vatican's dealings with Hitler, its pragmatic approach, is somehow to be condemned. What were they to do anyway? And of course, you know, if you look at our ally Stalin, Hitler was far more tolerant of religions, you know, except Masonry in Germany, than Stalin was, you know, and, and look what, I mean, let's face it, if the Catholic Church, the United States had come out, you know, four square against America's entry into World War II, even after a declaration of war, what would the American state done to the American Catholic Church? All states act that way, right? What would happen? I mean, and because, American prelates are so, loyal Americanists, they've supported every war, World War One, World War Two, Korea, Vietnam. But you know, Spellman never said anything about Vietnam. You know, and there's a reason for that, and it gets into a compromise. But so that's it, just one of these, when you just, for being, you know, for controlling your religions or threatening religions, all governments do that now. You know, it's look at today. Now government, look at the U.S. government today, telling churches they can't open or putting these restrictions on it in complete violation of its own charter, its constitution.
Yeah. And I think we can continue that discussion in the second hour, getting into the 1960s and some of those dealings with Vietnam, and maybe a little bit more on the Jesuits. And then also want to get more into the P2 lodges and Operation Gladio. But before we head over to the second hour for the members, I don't know if you wanted to let anybody know, what are the links? What are the best links to listen to our interesting times at and support you?
Oh, you can just go to my YouTube page, which is what, THKelly67. That's our interesting times. And there's links to Spreaker and also Podomatic. And then you can also find, you can donate at the About page at YouTube, and also on Patreon is open. Find it on Patreon. And there I host my own podcast, and I also do a weekly show with Joe Atwell. And we, discuss, you know, weekly topics. Some are historical, some are topical. Lately, we've been forced to do topical issues because of what's going on here in the United States and around the world with the attempted imposition of a technocratic slave state under the guise of a public health crisis.
Excellent. Well, I will put those in the links, and we'll see everyone at the second hour who's a subscriber.
To gain access to the second hour, head to www.rockstaresoterica.com and become a member to gain all access to all content at all times. Or to purchase individual episodes such as this one, head to schism206.podbean.com.